The person had never spoke to me before, one of the senior lawyers within the business. Pouring a rain, I'm walking down the steps of the business, walking down the street, and I can hear this, "Des, Des." I've turned round and it's this lawyer with a jacket on, poured on. "Delighted you've signed for the club. Lovely to meet you." And I thought, wow, that would never happen. I wouldn't have any idea of the impact that Partick Thistle would have on me and also the understanding of the size of club that it was.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the CSI Football Podcast, where we embark on a forensic delve into a particular season of football, usually with a tartan tint. I'm your host, Ian Stephen, and for today's episode, we meet a man who cringes every time someone mentions Dunder Mifflin. He turned down a Lisbon line, and I've put in brackets, not romantically, to forge his own path in football. He suffered a warrior's end to his career, but that opened up a variety of doors in the business world. He's former Queen of the South and Partick Thistle midfielder Des McKeown. Des, how are you, sir?
I'm good, Ian. Thank you very much. Thanks for the introduction and all of those nice little bits and the not so nice little bits.
So let's start at the very beginning. Where were you born and brought up, and who were your boyhood club?
Oh, that's going back a while. So I was born and raised in Milton of Campsie, which is just in the north side of the city, just outside of Kirkintilloch, home to Campsie Black Watch and Milton Battlefield, which were Scottish juvenile under 21 teams. My Uncle Jerry, late Uncle Jerry, managed Campsie Black Watch for over 70 years. So I was born and raised just at the foothills, or the foot of the Campsie Hills, Milton of Campsie. Born in 1970, born and raised in a village that basically four siblings, two brothers, two sisters, my mum and dad, and the family were all Celtic fans. So that was my introduction to football. Earliest memory was my brother Jerry lifting me over the turnstiles at Celtic Park to go and see Celtic versus Ayr United in 1977 in May. And it was actually one of Kenny Dalglish's last games for Celtic. Him and Johannes Edvaldsen scored for Celtic on the day in a 2-0 victory over Ayr United. That was my earliest memory of physically being at a football game.
Well, you mentioned Celtic. They became part of your kind of youth career, didn't they?
Yeah, I signed for Celtic on a part-time basis in 1987. I just started Jordan Hill College, where I was doing a sports science and sports management degree. I had it in my mind that I wanted to get my education organised. Believe it or not, I was actually quite bright. Attained quite a number of hires at St Ninian's High School, which ironically is now where the Celtic Academy footballers go. So in Kirkintilloch, went to St Ninian's High. Did fairly well academically, could have done a lot better if I hadn't been playing football 7 days a week prior to exams. But played for Easter Craig's Boys Club, a renowned Glasgow and Scottish boys club, East End of Glasgow, and from there Celtic asked me to go in trial, first of all to Vale of Clyde in a junior game for a testimonial for a Vale of Clyde player, and I played there on the Sunday, did okay, had played on the Saturday for Easter Craigs, played on the Sunday for Celtic in a mixture of reserves and prominent youth players, guys like Jerry Britton and Stevie Fulton were in that team, along with players like Tony Shepherd, Alan McKnight, Anton Rogan. Those were the kind of players that were in and around that team. I did okay, and Celtic then invited me up on a Tuesday evening to play at Dens Park in a Premier Reserve League game, where, for my luck, and it's pretty much why I was offered the contract, I'm pretty sure of it, Tommy Burns was coming back from injury and played directly in front of me. I played as a left fullback primarily, sometimes wide left in a five, sometimes in the middle of midfield. Probably over my career, most regularly was played as a left back because they couldn't find any others, to be fair. Anyway, I played as a left back that evening at Dens Park, and Tommy Burns, the late great Tommy Burns, was on the pitch and basically coached me throughout the game. Every time I had the ball, he was available to take the pass. every time he passed the ball to me, he was giving me an instruction with it. Straight after the game, Tommy sat next to me in the dressing room, was asking me, you know, what other interest there was in me, and I'd explained that there were a number of Premier League clubs in Scotland and indeed England that were kind of monitoring my progress. I had already had offers from Motherwell and Hearts. St Johnstone were very keen as well, but I hadn't done anything. And Tommy basically kind of sat next to me and asked me all about that, just as he was doing that. Bill McNeil, who was a manager at the time, and Tommy Craigie's assistant, came into the Dens Park dressing room, and they walked straight over to me and they said, "Des, you did very well, son. We would like to offer you a contract with Celtic." And Tommy Craig then said to Tommy Burns, "Tam, there's only one problem with this boy. He plays too much football." And Tommy Burns, I remember it to the day I die, tapped me in the thigh and said, "Des, you can't play too much football." And that was my start to professional football. I went into Celtic as a part-time player, and then it didn't develop as quickly as the full-time players. Clearly, they were in every day. I was getting in every time I could from college, played in the reserve team, and indeed, at that time, there was a Reserve League West team as well. So, played alongside some brilliant guys, from seasoned pros, McAvaney, Mark McGee, Mick McCarthy played, I think, my second reserve games at St Mirren. Mick McCarthy was playing, he was coming back from injury. So I get the opportunity to train with the first team on a number of occasions. And back then, Ian, I'm sure you'll appreciate it, it's not quite like it is now. I was telling somebody this the other day, there was probably only players in the squad. So the reserve team, maybe 30. The first team would have their 14, 15. Maybe Billy McNeil would ask for two or three to come up, and then the reserves and some of the youth players would train, you know, on a different pitch. We trained at Helen Vale, the old AstroTurf, while Celtic's first team were down at Barrowfield. And on a number of occasions, I was asked to go and train with the first team, which was absolutely nothing.
It was really interesting saying that about Tommy Burns, because there's a lot of that get quite precious when there's a youngster that gets involved and they wouldn't help them, they don't want them to come through because they might take their spot. That perhaps kind of shaped the way you fought later on when you were more of a veteran and there was youngsters coming through. Did you have the same approach as Tommy?
Very few people had the same approach as Tommy, I have to say. Tommy was a very unique individual and a beautiful human being, and I don't think you'll ever hear anybody say anything differently. But it certainly gave me an insight into what the young player felt, hearing from the experienced guy. And I've said to you, it'll live with me the day I die, I don't anticipate there will be any young player out there that I ever spoke to will be able to say that about something I said to them. But I do know that there are young players who, while I was even not at the veteran stage, but some of the guys in the Queen of the South team that I played alongside some of the younger ones in the Partick Thistle team, I would like to think I had a positive impact on them in terms of instilling in them certain habits and certain thought processes. As well as, you know, I was always of the opinion that you look after yourself. If you're doing your bit in the pitch, you'll be picked. So don't be too frightened about trying to help other people as well. And you know, I would like to think that the players that I played alongside would have seen me as a good teammate, somebody they could depend on. Was I 9 out of 10 every week? Absolutely not. I was very seldom a 2 out of 10. But more often than not, I was dependable and could be relied on and trusted.
As a kind of dyed-in-the-wool Celtic fan, were you able to do anything other than squeak when Billy McNeil spoke to you?
Believe it or not, it's bizarre. It truly is bizarre. I found myself in many situations throughout my life where I actually sometimes have to pinch myself afterwards, because I kind of took it in my stride. I knew that Billy McNeil was a Celtic great. I knew that he was the manager of the club. I knew that all he had done for the club during his time as a player and now as a manager. So, and this was his second spell at Celtic. So I really did know, you know, how important an individual he was, but it didn't affect me in terms of, I didn't feel that, you know, I didn't feel intimidated or nervous. And I've been like that most of my life. I don't get spooked or you know, you said, did you squeak? It wasn't overconfidence. It was just Mr. McNeil, and I would shake his hand, and that was it. It didn't really, looking back on it, I could understand why I could have been quivering in my boots, but I wasn't. And I think that maybe is how I've approached meeting certain individuals throughout my life, in football and outside of football, where I've been very privileged to meet a lot of really, really talented and really important people.
When you're a youngster coming through at some of the big clubs in Scotland, it's probably in the high 90% chance that the club's going to say thanks but no thanks. But is it true that you, in effect, broke up with Celtic?
Not sure I broke up with him. I made a conscious decision, Ian, that I wanted to continue with my studies. And at the end of the season, it was conveyed to me that the club felt that I would need to go full-time to be able to develop at the rate that they thought I needed to develop. And I was 1 year into a three-year degree course at Jordan Hill and decided that then that wasn't for me. I think there's a line in, you know, my narrative somewhere that I never get my ambitions mixed up with my abilities. Was I good enough to play in Celtic's first team? Probably not. In fact, I'm pretty sure I wasn't, or I would have probably been given that opportunity. But guys like, so Jerry Craney was the only other timer when I was there. And Jerry then went full-time the next season. He'd finished school, he'd finished his sixth year at school, I think, and then went full-time. And within a year, he was scoring goals for the first team and then transferred down to Portsmouth and Man City. Played a great career, you know, and that might have happened, but I'm quite content that I made the decision and I've done okay. I've done absolutely fine. I've had a good kick at it in football. I've also, alongside my football, I've performed fairly well in business, and I say fairly well, not brilliantly, but you know, been involved in 30 years now, in my own business for the guts of 20. So I've done okay. I'm all right. I'm happy with that. I think the decision I made was the right decision for me. Many other boys, players, and now girls getting into football might make a different decision, but it might not work out just quite as well for them.
You still wanted to keep playing football, though, so you ended up moving to North Lancashire to keep your kind of footballing career going.
Yeah, I got a number of offers back then. And again, I'm now involved from a different perspective in football in terms of advising players. But back then, if you were being released or if you decided to leave Celtic, you were getting offers from multiple clubs. That wasn't, you know, it wasn't as if there was a raft of 15 players leaving Celtic every season. It was one or two. And back then, what actually happened was Alec Totten was really keen to take me to St Johnstone and told me about the McDermott Park plan. They were still at Muirton Park. And there was a group of guys came up in a minibus from Buchanan Street in Glasgow every night for training, or every twice a week. And it was guys like Sammy Johnston, Alan Moore, Harry Curran, all guys that went on to do really, really well with St Johnstone. Gordon McQueen was keen to sign me for Airdrieonians, and I had two or three other options available to me as well, but the two main ones were in the what's now the Championship. Back then it was the First Division, so the second tier of Scottish football, and it was a choice between Alec Totten and Gordon McQueen or St Johnstone and Airdrieonians. And I just and the real reason I picked Airdrie was I felt that while I was still studying at Jordan Hill, there was a direct train line from Partick, basically, straight out to Airdrie. And for training purposes, I thought that would be the best situation for me. And I signed for Airdrie. I signed a two-year deal at Airdrie.
We'll bookmark the name Alec Totten because he crops up later.
Yes, he does. He get the last laugh.
Is this the Airdrie side that has the kind of incredibly tough characters? Guys like John Martin would have been there at the time, I think. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah, John Martin was there. I think they went to another level when they, because I went there, they were part-time, they were all part-time. And it was guys like John Martin, club legend, Brian McEwen, club legend, namesake of mine, but no relation. And both of those guys had a testimonial the following season. They had been there for 10 years. John Flood, Tam Black, loads of really Innes McDonald, Kenny McDonald, Sammy Conn signed at the same time as me, who had a great career around Airdrie, Falkirk, etc. So it was a tough place. Back then you had to be able to handle yourself because there was physical contact in football unlike nowadays. But the mentality was tough, and the boys were all really good pro. Dave McKinnon, ex-Rangers and Partick Thistle, he was a right back at the time. So it was a good group of players. The Beastie Boy type players came further down the line because that was kind of Doddy's Diamonds after Jimmy Bone left. When Gordon left, Jimmy Bone came in. I left, but Alec McDonald came in after that. And that was when they kind of got the reputation of being really physical. And that was Jimmy Boyle, Paul Jack, Sandy Stewart, Kenny Black, a whole host of real season gnarly pros. But by the way, good teammates, good players.
Well, you didn't go very far when you left, just along the road to Albion Rovers.
That's very true. So again, the kind of thing that happened there was after season one at Airdrie, Gordon McQueen left because the club wouldn't go full time, was conveyed to us. And then Jimmy Bone came in and the club went full time. So I was again one of the part-timers, but Airdrie had more part-timers at that point because they were just transitioning to full time. But Jimmy very quickly brought in a lot of good players, a lot of full-time pros. Mr. DL of DL Bakers was back in the club at that time. I think he bought Owen Coyle, he bought John Davies, but he bought a lot of good players. Paul Harvey, loads of different players. Anyway, I moved on because, again, I was slightly an outside looking in because it was now I was training night times. Most of the boys were training during the day. So Albion Rovers had won the second division the previous year under David Proven and Joe Baker. And David Proven had taken the club into the first division. So around about Christmas time, David Proven was given permission to speak to me. He actually paid money for me, which is unbelievable. But anyway, he bought me for Albion Rovers, and I played my first game. I'm sure it was just after Christmas, and it was against Clyde Bank at Kilbowie Park, and we beat them 3-1, and I scored the first goal. I was playing as a left midfielder then. And that was us off to a great start in my Albion Rovers career. But unfortunately, I think we missed out. We get relegated either in goal difference or by 1 point. Alloa just kept above us. So, yeah, I was Albion Rovers just down the road from Airdrie. And again, played with a lot of really good individuals there, good guys. And actually, then when Davy left, Mick Oliver came in. Tommy Gemmell then came in as well. Tommy managed the club for a period. And then Billy McLaren had come in. Billy had been at Hamilton, was out of the game, came into Albion Rovers. And that was actually the conduit that took me to Queen of the South further down the line because Billy left Albion Rovers to go to Queen of the South. And he came back and he bought me from Albion Rovers because back then it was, I think it was pre-Bosman actually. It wasn't, in fact, it would have been pre-Bosman. So Queen of the South bought me from Albion Rovers after four and a bit seasons at Albion Rovers.
So how can you describe playing at Palmerston? Because they're one of the clubs where they recruit heavily from the Central Belt and kind of training and playing. There's a lot of kind of travelling to and fro. How would you describe the experience at Queen of the South from a logistical perspective?
Well, it's funny, Ian, because the logistical element changed while I was there. So year one, when Bill McLaren signed me, we did the entire pre-season weekends down in Dumfries. One of the former club greats, Billy Hulliston, had his son Keith had a hotel just on the River Nith. And we used to go down there. We used to have a kind of pre-season camp. We'd go down and train double session Saturday, double session Sunday back up the road. But during the week, while the pre-season was going on, we were doing our pre-season Glasgow brigade, and it was predominantly Central Belt, as you said. We would train in Glasgow, And during the course of the season, we would train in Glasgow two nights a week and just travel down for home games. And Queen of the South did it really well. We would be picked up at Bayliston in a bus, taken down. There was generally food before each game, so it was almost a pre-matcher every week because we were travelling down to Dumfries. So they looked after us very well. Then when Billy left, Mark Shanks and Ron Alexander came in, and in the first instance, they wanted us to train down in Dumfries. So we were down there Tuesday night, Thursday night, and then playing wherever we were playing on a Saturday. There was also the introduction of some full-time players who featured in that 96, 97, 98 period. Young players, predominantly, who'd maybe been with other clubs or had perhaps been scouted. And they formed the nucleus of the full-time group during the day. And then they would train possibly Monday morning, Tuesday night with us, Wednesday morning, Thursday night with us, then a session on the Friday mornings. It's similar to what some of the kind of hybrid clubs are doing now. But we were travelling up and down twice a week. And here was the issue. And I'm not proud to say this, I'm not ashamed to say this, but I was doing my business stuff during the day, so I was working during the day. And that meant that on a Tuesday and a Thursday, I was heading to Dumfries, and I was getting back at 11:30 at night, both nights. Then possibly going down to Dumfries all day Saturday. I had two young daughters at the time, and that was what suffered in terms of my time at home. I was working during the day, then two nights a week was at Dumfries. And I suppose the support of my wife and the fact that she never ever had an issue with it and allowed me to continue my playing career, that was why that worked. But for a lot of people, it wouldn't have worked because of the amount of time away from home. So logistically, it was okay. I would drive up and down twice a week and on a Saturday if need be. And listen, I got to know that road like the back of my hand. I could have driven it in the dark with no lights on. But with a great car, brilliant car. So the likes of Stevie Mallon, Jim Thompson, George Rowe, real good pals of mine still. The guys that I've grown up with and still see on a fairly regular basis, and I'm in touch with them regularly. That kind of solidified the team spirit within that group as well.
You mentioned Ron Alexander. I think people kind of forget that he was at Queen of the South. He's kind of really associated more with Gretna and the run that they had. How did you find Ron as a manager?
Ron was great. Ron was really good. And listen, Ron had a brilliant career. I played against Ron when he was at Morton. You'll not thank me for saying this, but I was too young to play against him when he was at Queen of the South prior to moving to Morton. But Ron was a very straightforward individual. And again, when I look back on the managers that I worked for, and I tried to take this into my own managerial coaching style, guys were just straightforward. It was right down the middle. There was no black, white. There was no trying to second guess what they were thinking. They told you. Billy McLaren, brutal, absolutely brutal, but also brilliant, because if you deserved praise, you got it. If you deserved criticism, you got it. There was no grey area. It was, you were told, and it was told directly to you in front of other people, and there were no blushes spared, there were no egos to be had. If you deserved a rollicking, you got it. If you deserved praise, you got it. And those were the kind of guys that I worked for. If you think, you know, Tommy Gemmell was like that, Davy Provan, Gordon McQueen, but Billy McNeil, Rowan Alexander, Billy McLaren, John Lambie, all these guys, old-fashioned, just told you the way it was. And I liked that. I liked that. I didn't want to be trying to... I'm not quite sure what he meant there. Or am I included in that? He told you. So Rowan was like that as well. Him and Mark Shanks were pretty much co-managers initially, I think. And then just between the two of them, the message got told. So there wasn't a manager I worked for. Jimmy Bone, first time round I fell out with when he was at Airdrie. However, he then signed me for Stennis Muir when I left Queen of the South the second time. And Jimmy, brilliant. I've got a great relationship with Jimmy. Jimmy, first time round, he was, well, that was 1990-ish. 1989, maybe 1990. Jimmy was younger. He was brash, and he would be pretty ferocious in his thoughts. When I signed for him, it's Dennis Muir. Actually, the club were in a position that they were struggling a bit, and Jimmy had mellowed. And if the old Jimmy had been at Dennis Muir, it would have been a different situation altogether, I think. You know, he'd maybe mellowed slightly, and he was still as passionate about football, and he was still a terrific coach. But he probably, as a younger manager, he wouldn't have allowed the slight malaise in the dressing room that happened. He would have dealt with it in a different way. So, Rowan, getting back to him, yeah, straightforward, had a really good relationship with him, looked at me as one of the kind of senior guys in that group, along with the likes of George Rowe, David Kennedy, Tommy Bryce, Big Jimmy came in as well, Stevie Marlin. So that was his kind of nucleus of experienced guys.
What did the kind of successful seasons in Queen of the South history, you were part of it in 97-98 when they got to the final of the Challenge Cup. I think it's easy for some clubs to discount the Challenge Club, possibly because they don't take part in it. But for footballers who maybe don't play for like the Big Five and get into a cup final, it's realistically not going to happen in their career. The Challenge Cup is something that they do enjoy, especially when you get to the later stages. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think until you experience it at a club like Queen of the South, now Queen of the South have gone on post my time at the club, and they've competed. Actually, it was co-commentary for the Scottish Cup final in 2008, where they played against Rangers, and they played in Europe, and they've won leagues, and they've won the Challenge Cup since. But I think that was their first national final in their history, so it was a remarkable achievement to get to that cup, even though it wasn't the Scottish Cup or the League Cup. You wouldn't have known. There were no buses to be had in the Dumfries and Carlisle area because the amount of people who wanted to go to the final to see this. Again, it'll live with me forever. We stayed overnight down in Lockerbie on a Saturday night, and we travelled up on Sunday for the game at Fir Park, and it was literally a procession of buses with blue and white colours. The Queen of the South fans were lit. It was the M74 was like a car park. It was just absolutely jammed with supporters coming up to the game, and that was brilliant to see because it meant so much to the community. And the club, you know, hadn't kind of hit the heights that they had probably wanted to. I mean, way back in the 60s, my wife Carolyn, her uncle, her late uncle William, played for the club, and that was a proper, you know, top flight club. They were regularly competing with Celtic, Rangers, Hibs, Hearts, Aberdeen, and beating them in many occasions. So never quite won anything, but they were in the top flight of Scottish football all part-time. But the club hadn't really hit the heights that they would have wanted to. They had been in the second tier when I was at Airdrie, that they were in the second tier, but then they'd slipped down to the third tier. And it meant a lot to the supporters because there had been a significant investment in the club from Norman Blunt, who was the new chairman, and his associates, his board. And this was the first step, I think, that they saw on the road back to where they wanted to get to. And the Challenge Cup provided a brilliant platform for that.
I mean, you started off the run with a very early defeat in August of Inverness Caledonian Thistle, a very youthful Inverness Caledonian Thistle. I think they're just recently conglomerated. Then you took on Stirling Albion, a 2-0 win against Stirling. Your old club Airdrie, 3-2 win against Airdrie. Is it kind of nice to go when you face your old teams just to get a wee win? I mean, you don't want to be mean, but you must have a little bit of satisfaction knowing you beat an old club.
It didn't really mean anything to me, to be honest, Dean. That wasn't something that spurred me on. It was, I still have a terrific relationship with the fans of the clubs that I played for. And I put that down to the fact that I wasn't the best player, but I always gave 100%. I think that was the kind of common theme across the clubs that I played for. I would always give 100%. So it wasn't as if I 1-0 to me, you know, I'm getting one up in my old club. It didn't matter. As long as whoever we were playing, as long as we won, that was really all that mattered to me. So the fact it was Airdrie, neither up nor down.
Well, semi-final, and it was Morton that were dispatched 2-0, which takes you into a final against...
Well, can I jump in? The semi-final, interestingly. So the day of the semi-final, I'm working in Glasgow. I'm going to see some clients in and around the city centre. And around about lunchtime, I start to feel a migraine coming on. And I very occasionally get migraines, but the symptom for me is blurred vision. So my peripheral vision all closes in, it's cloudy. I get a splitting headache, and very occasionally, I'm sick. So I'm sitting in my car on West Campbell Street in Glasgow at about 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock. I had to get out of my car to be sick in one of the lanes that ran off of West Campbell Street. And we've got this semi-final that night at Capello. And I can't eat anything because it's going to come back up. And I'm actually at the stage where I'm thinking I need to tell the club I'm possibly going to be struggling for this game. So long story boring, took a couple of tablets to help with the migraine reliever, some tablet that I had at the time, it always had available to me. And by about 4 o'clock, I was starting to feel okay again. So I hadn't made a call to Rowan or Shanks. So I thought, I'll be okay. Tried to eat something, managed to keep something down, and then played. And I actually felt fantastic on the night. I felt brilliant on the night. And it was a brilliant performance from the team because Morton were a league above, I think. I'm pretty sure they were back up, and it was a Alan McGraw team with loads of young players. I'm sure Derek McInnes, Brian Reid, that was that kind of group that were there at the time. And we beat them at Capello, which for Rowan Alexander, I think, was probably pretty sweet because he had obviously previously been at Morton as well. So that was the build-up to the game. And then we totally dominated the game and we won. And that was us through the final, which... And again, the celebrations to get to the final. Because what actually happens back then, and I'm not sure if it still happens, but back then, the Inverness game was almost an extension of early season form, trying to get into the rhythm of things. Then you take on Stirling Albion and okay, we've won again. So that's us now up to the kind of quarter. And again, back then it was only the Scottish League clubs that were involved. There weren't as many clubs involved in the tournament because obviously in recent years we've brought in Welsh, Irish clubs to try and, you know, extend it a bit. I think there's also Colt teams, all that kind of stuff. Back then it was literally any club outside the top flight, that was it. So very quickly we're into quarterfinals, and then it starts to get interesting. That's when you start to think, oh, I wonder, maybe we could, maybe, you know, do you know what I mean? And then by the semi-final, you win this. We're in a national final. So the celebrations that night at Capello were terrific.
Now, I've just had the legal team on the headphones to me. They just wanted to point out to disgruntled Morton fans, it was a perfectly legal migraine-relieving pill that you took. It was not performance-enhancing at all. So I'm in the same situation as you, Des. I get migraines as well, and I know I can empathise 100% with you, and I know that judgment we are having to make of, am I going to be all right or not? I think it's an absolute miracle that you played, and I think you're glad, you're delighted that you did. When you look at the final, I mean, in the Queen of the South team, the one name that jumps out immediately is your number 10, Ken Eady, who is a man who scored 200 goals in the Scottish League as a striker. What can you tell us about Ken?
Well, what I can tell you is he never scored that day, unfortunately. And he came off after 48 minutes. I've just looked at that. No, Kenny was brilliant because Kenny was probably the highest profile part-time footballer in Scotland. Kenny had a really good job. And that was the only reason he was historically at Clydebank. I think he'd started at Hearts. He'd been at Falkirk, but he played at Clydebank. I remember him most at Clydebank. He scored goals galore. But long story again, went to Airdrie, I'm sure. And then, you know, it comes to Queen of the South, and we're thinking, wow, what a signing that is. And sometimes, and this has always been the case for me, and it's always been the case for guys who maybe play against me, and have got a different opinion of you till you turn up and you play for that team. And I always thought Kenny would have been, I thought he was different to the way he actually was. And I don't mean that from a personality point of view, I mean that from a playing perspective. Now, granted, he was older by that point, but he was actually, it wasn't so much physical with him, it was cute movement, it was really clever movement. I always kind of found Kenny, my perception of him was that he was more physical, and he was elbows, and he was leaning into people. Now, he did that as well, but actually he was a very, very cute footballer. And all he said to me when he first arrived, took me aside before the first game, and he said, "Don't even think about it, hit the back post." That was it, hit the back post. And sure enough, I would try and get it on my feet and clip it to the back post. And his movement was always to the front post, check, and go to the back post. And he was brilliant in there, and not particularly tall, but he was brilliant in there. And he was terrific as a foil for the likes of Craig Flanagan, who'd come at the club as well, Stevie Mallon, who'd been there. And I think those wee tips and wee nuggets that he handed out to teammates kind of underlines the kind of person he was as well.
When you look at the Falkirk side of that final, I mean, it's stacked in terms of talent. Guys like Scott McKenzie, Kevin James, who grew a foot every time somebody mentioned him.
You saw him.
Neil Berry, Crunchy McAllister, who's a nightmare for anybody that's a fullback. Albert Craig, Paul McGrillan, David Hagan, who'd score. The bench had Neil Oliver and Brian Hamilton and Marine O'Keefe. The manager was a guy that had got Falkirk to the cup final as well, Alec Totten, a man who, yep. When I was at the club a couple of years ago, and they had a massive turnover of players, and as I was leaving the ground, Alec Totten was there, and he held the door open for me, and another player came through, and the player went, "That doorman's really friendly." And I went, "It's not the doorman, that's Alec Totten."
The legend.
Clearly, this was a very new player to the team, but it would have been a the kind of odds would have been stacked, I think, against Queen of the South in that final. What are your memories of the final? Are you able to talk about it with any fondness, or does it still hurt you very much as a player?
It hurts me, the fact that we lost the game. I can speak with fondness in terms of the occasion, and I've already mentioned about the transportation up to Fir Park. It was truly incredible. I mean, literally every car that passed or we passed, every bus was bedecked in Queen of the South colours. It was remarkable. It was truly remarkable. And that kind of got us an idea of the scale of what was going to hit us when we got into the stadium. And it was one of the very few games, I might even say, and I should know this, I think it might have been the only game my mum ever came to watch. Now, I'll say that again, it might be the only game my mum ever came to watch me. Nowadays, mums, dads, aunties, uncles, girlfriends, boyfriends, everybody turns up to watch football now. Back then, my dad hardly came to watch me. That was because I asked him not to, but because he was my biggest critic. But I think it was the only game my mum ever came to, and she was up in the stand. And it was clearly, the odds were against us, but I'm going to say that Queen of the South outnumbered the Falkirk fans probably 2-1. It was just under 10,000 at the game. It was amazing. And the aftermath of the game, I'll deal with the aftermath before on the pitch. The aftermath of the game, I was crying going around the stadium, going around the pitch. There were tears in my eyes because I just felt that the supporters deserved better. I thought they deserved to be down the road with a cup going to Palmerston. Because I think we probably edged the game. We were terrific in the game. Tommy Bryce was man of the match and was outstanding, absolutely outstanding. At that point, I think Tommy was 78. He was getting better every year. I think he was 38, but he looked 78. But he was amazing. But we never delivered it. So I was really deflated after the game, and also because of my performance during the game. I was deflated, not because I didn't play well, I just couldn't get involved in a game. I played as a wide left. It was a kind of 3-5-2, and I literally couldn't get involved. The ball just seemed to gravitate to the right-hand side. And I say this to people who still remember that game. I think I took three throw-ins and maybe get two kicks of the ball. That's what it felt like. It was just so frustrating. And I must have ran 14, 15K. I was non-stop up and down the pitch because I was covering the whole left-hand side. But I never got a touch. It was so, so frustrating. Whereas Tommy, Derek Townsley, Davy Kennedy in the far side of the pitch, everything just seemed to flow. And sometimes that happens. Sometimes that happens. But for it to happen in a cup final where you just feel you're unaudy and hardly take part in the game, it was frustrating for me. I did what I could do. I did what I had to do. But I just couldn't really influence the game because the ball just couldn't come in my direction. Now, many people would say I would never have influenced it anyway. Probably better keeping it away from me. But that was my abiding memory of the game. That the goal we lost was potentially a foul. I think Davy Hagan, God bless him, no longer with us. Paul McGrillan, a former teammate of mine, sadly no longer with us as well. There was a wee nudge in Jimmy Thompson and Davy Hagan scores. And Bobby Tate, referee, who takes great delight in telling me that when we're speaking together in the after-dinner circuit, that the two biggest games in my career were probably the Challenge Cup final in 1997 and a reserve Old Firm game back in 1988, where we were winning 3-1 against Rangers at Celtic Park in front of about 11,000. And Rangers won 4-3, so Bobby will tell people, you know, the two biggest games in my career, he refereed them and I get pumped in both. So that's Bobby for you. But Bobby was the ref, never gave it. Obviously, back then, there was no VAR. Linesman wasn't really a decision for them. And then we had a chance. Derek Townsley had a chance. Derek, who then moved on to Hibs and finished up Gretna, I think. Derek had a brilliant chance and just snatched at it and put it over the bar. And that was when we thought, you know what? It's not going to be our day. And then I went off after, I think, 83 minutes. I had cramp in every muscle in my body because I'd ran that far, touching the ball. Jamie McAllister, a young player who came on for me and had a terrific career and has had a terrific career in management as well, along with, his counterpart, Lee Johnson. So, those are my abiding memories of that day. And then we'd to go back down, there was not a civic reception, but there was a reception for the players in Dumfries. And any sadness or disappointment kind of washed away when we saw the amount of people that came out to welcome us back to the town. And they had the party as if they'd won it anyway. So very quickly, you get caught up in that and you're speaking to people and they were just delighted that they experienced it because they didn't think, Queen of South fans at that stage probably didn't think they would ever see what would happen with the club 10 years later when they're in Europe and Scottish Cup finals, etc. So those are my memories of the day. We had the chance. Falkirk took. I hardly touched the ball. My mum was in the stand and the crowd were phenomenal. There you go. Wrap that up.
Well, of course, Jamie McAllister obviously learned a lot from you in that final because he scored in the League Cup final for Livy as well. So
that's right.
Once you left Queen of the South, you moved to Thistle in 98 and you became introduced to one of the more Presbyterian characters in Scottish football and John Lambie. Are you able to tell any John Lambie stories that don't ruin any of your after dinner stories?
No, I can tell a couple of stories about John, but it was actually Tommy Bryce, my teammate in that game at Firth Park, that signed me for. In fact, the backstory is John McVeigh was the manager of Partick Thistle that season, and John McVeigh and Peter Heatherson, his assistant, were at the semi-final and watched. Now, I knew Peter anyway, so I was friendly with Peter, and I knew John because he'd been at Airdrie with Alan McDonald, and everybody knew John because John was a football nut. He would know everybody involved in every team at every level because that was the way John functioned. But John and Peter had came to the semi-final at Morton. And from that day, they had kind of earmarked that they would consider me for the summer, because by that time my contract was up and I would have been available to move. So come the end of the season, Queen of the South wanted to retain me. There are a number, Ross County are interested, Forfar, there was a few clubs interested, but Partick Thistle were also interested. And I went to meet John McVeigh at Firhill. I should know the date. I think it was the 25th of May, but don't quote me on that one. And the reason I should know is, you'll see behind me the picture, Mr. Sinatra, right? So John McVeigh and I met at Firhill. The next day, John McVeigh got sacked. So that was that deal up. And Frank Sinatra died on the same day, right? So you'll be able to work that out, what date it was. It was the end of May. Frank died, John McVeigh got sacked. I don't know what upset me most. It looked as though the Partick Thistle interest had gone, but then out of nowhere, Tommy Bryce was appointed co-manager with Sammy Johnston, and Willie Jimison was involved as well. So the club had just come through to save the Jags, but they were skint, absolutely skint. And the board at the time had effectively issued a situation where it would be a hybrid club. So there were many talented young players. Kenny Arthur, who went on to play, you know, hundreds of games for the club. Alan Archibald, brilliant servant for the club. Alan Morgan, tragically, at the start of next season, his career came to an end. Robert Dunn, decent player. Derek Lyle. There was loads of players around that they were saying, this is a nucleus of the group moving forward, but we need to supplement that with pros that have been around the block, but they're part-time, they'll come in and train at night. So Tommy Bryce was given a job as a manager and he wanted to take me with him. So that was how I turned up and arrived at Firhill. And I have to say that absolutely oblivious to the size of the club. Now, I worked in Glasgow on a regular basis. 3 days out of five, I would be in the city centre and around and get into some of the big legal firms and some of the top professional services businesses. And nobody would ever, other than the contacts I was dealing with, nobody really ever identified me as a footballer. After I signed for Partick Thistle, I was coming out of a big legal firm in Glasgow, pouring the rain. And I'd just been announced probably about 2 weeks previous, so website and all that kind of stuff. And I'm coming out of this legal firm, walking down, I'll not tell you the street, because whoever listens to this might actually identify the individual, but the person had never spoke to me before, one of the senior lawyers within the business. Pouring a rain, I'm walking down the steps of the business, walking down the street, and I can hear this, Des, Des. I've turned round and it's this lawyer with a jacket on, getting poured on. Delighted you've signed for the club, lovely to meet you. And I thought, wow, that would never happen. I wouldn't have any idea of the impact that Partick Thistle would have on me, and also the understanding of the size of club that it was. But I found that out very quickly, because even in pre-season, there was big crowds, there was big expectations. Sadly, there weren't enough big results. And Tommy paid the price round about Christmas time. I think we started the season 7 wins out of seven. Alan Morgan got injured. Then it all kind of unravelled. But who did Partick Thistle turn to, of course? They turned to the prodigal son for the 18th time. In comes John Lambie. Oh, wow. What an introduction I got. I was in a train heading from Bristol to Reading on business, and I got a phone call, and it was John Lambie. Can he use the words that he used? Because John, as I say regularly, is the man that invented Tourette's. John gave me a mouthful, because I had publicly said I felt sorry for Tommy Bryce, that I was a captain at the club, and I felt sorry for Tommy Bryce, and I didn't think it was the right decision. And John, what he gave me over the phone, don't you ever comment on club business in the papers. You need to remember, Partick Thistle are paying your money, blah, 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 blah. So that was, you know, absolutely punctuated by expletives. So when I get back up from Reading or London, wherever I'd been, I went in to see him. And I knew right away I was going to like him, because he just, that was him. He told you right between the eyes. I mean, there was literally nothing at all that you were left thinking, what did he mean by that? Because he told you, it just came out. And alongside Jerry Collins, his trusted lieutenant, he was exactly cut for the same cloth. So I loved working under both the guys. And when I left, I know I'm kind of jumping about a bit here. When I left the club, again, they had flipped to being full-time. John had come in, worked miracles. More money had been invested in the team. So guys like Danny Lennon were coming in. Brian Hamilton, Albert Craig had been there for a period as well. They were starting to get full-time again. So again, I'm one of the two or three guys that are part-time. Big Martin Hardy went from being part-time to full-time and had a fantastic career across a number of clubs. But I'm pretty much one of two part-timers. So I know John doesn't really want part-time players involved, just because that's the way John is. He wants to be able to have full control of the squad. And there are a number of clubs that are interested in buying me from Partick Thistle. One being Queen of the South, another one being, I think Forth, and we're back in again. Ian McPhee, a former teammate, I mean, Airdrie Onings was involved there, I think. So anyway, he tells me that John Connolly, his former St Johnston teammate, who's now in charge at Palmerston, John Connolly wants to buy you. John Connolly wants you. I says, right, okay. I says, well, what are you saying? Oh, no, it's your decision, son. It's your decision. It's up to you, you know. I says, well, Gaffer, I'll cut to the chase. I says, would you rather you had my wage to invest into a full-time player so that you didn't need to have to worry about me being a part-time player? You could actually use that money and get somebody else in. Aye, that's exactly what I'd like to do. I says, right, I'll go. Dead simple. I just wanted to play, and I wasn't playing regularly enough at Thistle. Stephen Cragan had come in. He was playing. Alan Archibald was playing as a kind of left wing back, so that was me kind of put to the side. I was still coming off the bench and doing okay and dependable enough. And John had actually given me a contract a couple of years, a year earlier. He'd extended my contract. But when he told me, no, that's what I want to happen, I just says, well, listen, I'll make it easy for you. I just want to play football. And that was all I ever did. The fact that I was paid to play football was an absolute bonus. Some people would say that I shouldn't have been, but the fact I was paid with a bonus, I would have played the same way if I'd not been getting paid. That was just the way I was. So I left and went to Queen of the South. But the story that one of the stories that I do tell, and this is absolute fact, and this kind of gives you an idea, John. Post-playing career, I'm working for BBC Radio Scotland, but I'm doing my column in the Sun at the time. On a Wednesday night, I usually kind of wrote my column on a Wednesday night, started to get it kicked into place. I would look over it again the Thursday night and file it on the Thursday night, so it was in the inbox on the Friday morning for the sports editor. Published on a Saturday, back page of the middle insert. And on a Wednesday night, I'm sitting on the laptop, giving it a bit of yee-haw, and I got a phone call coming in for Chick Charlie. I'm like, Chick, how you doing, mate? Aye, good day as you. I said, aye, what are you up to? There it is. Wonder if you'd help. I've got a book signing. He'd his book coming out, Seeing Red was the name of the book. Chick's 448 red cards. So Seeing Red was the name of the book. He says, I wonder if you could give me a wee plug in your column. There's a book signing in the Aitken Suite at Fir Hill on Saturday ahead of the game versus Inverness. He says, no problem at all, Chick. I'll do that for you. We're there for 12:30, right, no bother. So I've added in a wee bubble onto the bottom of my column for Thistle fans and indeed Scottish football fans. Get along to Fir Hill on Saturday. This was also top of the table clash. Terry Butcher, Inverness, Ian McCall's, Partick Thistle. Whoever wins basically goes up to the top flight. Get along to Scottish football's top game. Get along to the Aitken Suite. Buy Chick Chanley's book, Seeing Red. Chick will be there in person doing a book signing. It'll start at 12:30, but make sure you're there before 2:00 because Chick doesn't do 90 minutes. Right, that was my wee out, bang, done. So, as luck would have it, the producer of Sports Sound speaks to me on the Thursday morning. Des, we're going through the list for this week. How do you fancy doing Thistle versus Inverness? Brilliant, love it. So that's fine. So I'm standing at the tunnel at Fir Hill waiting on the team news from Ian McCall and Terry Butcher. and I see John Lambie coming out of the Aitken suite between the dugouts and coming up the touchline towards where I am. And he's been in, his pals, Chick Chanley, he's looked after Chick, Chick's looked after him. And he's been into the book signing and he's walked towards me with half a dozen books. So again, he's helping out his pal. So I'm on the studio, listen, I've got Chick, I've got John Lambie coming towards me. Maybe do a wee scene set for the game. Great idea. We'll come to you. We'll get Richard Gordon to come to you. So I'm thinking I'll also get Chick's book mentioned in this. And the trick to John is, on live broadcast, John would get tongue-tied because he couldn't swear. So I'm thinking I need to be pretty straightforward with John here so that he doesn't swear. So I can hear Richard Gordon saying, we can now go to Firhill, Glasgow. Des McKeown is with Partick Thistle legend John Lambie. John, how you doing? Aye, I'm good, son. I'm good, son. How are you? I says, I'm fine, John. Listen, John, just ahead of the game. This is me thinking I'm getting Chick's book mentioned. I see you've just been in at Chick Chanley's book signing. Aye, what about it? All right, okay. And I don't know why I said it, but I didn't know you could read. And John's reply, true story, don't you start me. I love a right good antibiotic. That's what he says to me. I love a right good antibiotic. I think he meant autobiography, but anyway, I don't know if that's what he meant. So John was brilliant. John was absolutely brilliant. And every story you hear about John, trust me, it'll be true. You know, everything from you three are a pair of idiots, all that stuff, and a plethora of quotes that John will have said it'll be true, because he was an absolute one-off.
You had to, I mean, you talked about leaving Thistle, you went back to Queen of the South, and you were the subject of a book yourself at that point, the Queen of the South. Was there kind of resistance in the footballing community about perhaps having secrets revealed or background revealed, or were people quite happy for you to go ahead with it?
I'm not sure everybody knew I was doing it, to be honest, Ian. I mean, it wasn't something that was, I'm doing a book. Now, it was the Sun started to do fortnightly, well, they were going to do excerpts from it, but actually what they said was, well, why don't you actually do what you're doing in the book as a kind of diary of a part-time footballer? So it was called Desi's Diary, funnily enough, initially. Then it was just Des McKeown, the man from football, from the shop floor of football, or football shop floor or something. Anyway, it was originally Desi's Diary every 2 weeks. It came from, I was down doing my A licence at Larg, and I was sitting one night in a bar, a pub, as you do when you're down there. I was teetotal at the time, so I'm sitting with my glass of water or whatever, but all the boys are having a laugh, and they're talking football and chatting away, and I'm sitting next to Alex Smith. And the guys on the course at that stage were guys like Gus McPherson, Pat Bonner, Craig Levine, Brian Rice, a whole host of guys, really experienced pros, and me, still playing. Neil Cooper was there. There was a load of guys. And this night in this bar, the boys, and it's always football chat. We're all chatting football and what about this? And Alex Smith speaks to me. He sat next to me. He said, how you doing, Dad? Good. And he said, he just posed a question. He said, have you got out your career what you should have got out of it? That's a good question, Alex. And I've only been 27 at the time, maybe 28. I says, I think so. I says, I'm not sure I could have done any more or got any better or got to a level. I said, the one thing that, you know, has probably held me back is my pace. I wasn't quick. I could run all day, but I wasn't quick. He says, aye, but Des, how many times do you get caught in a game? I says, well, not that often. If it's a pure foot race, then I'll be caught out, but not that often. He says, aye, because you read the game. You're aware of what's happening. Aye, aye, aye. He says, what managers have picked you? I says, what do you mean, Alex? He says, well, what managers have actually put you into their team? So I rhymed off all these managers. Gordon McQueen, Billy McNeil, Davy Provan, the Rangers, Tommy Gemmell, Billy McClatt. And I'm rhyming them off. And he says, baby, there's a book in you. That's what he said. There's a book in you. Right? I didn't think anything of it at the time. But here I'm going over on holiday to Florida, and this is in my mind. There's an idea. I would quite fancy doing this book about part-time footballers, and not every part-time footballer devoted themselves the way me or my group of friends did. Because back then it was kind of part-time footballer, you know, it's you're not as fit as the full-timers, which was absolutely rubbish, etc., etc. So anyway, part-time, and I thought I'm going to try and shine a light on the sacrifices I make, but it's not just about me. The guys like Tommy Bryce had been doing it for, you know, 20 odd years. George Rowe building a business while he's still playing football. Jimmy Thompson owned business playing football. Stevie Mallon digging holes in the road and playing football. It's not quite, you know, it's not about glamour. It's about the nuts and bolts of these guys are sacrificing to be involved in professional football. So nobody really opposed it. And actually, when it came out, I've had some lovely comments about it from people. I had a beautiful letter from Arthur Montford, believe it or not. And I've still got it upstairs in a wee box of special memories. And Arthur Montford sent me a beautiful letter. He had read my book and he just wanted to comment on it and say, you know, that he really enjoyed it and it gave him a great insight into part-time football. Jack Ross, long before Jack was on the managerial ladder, I used to work with Jack every now and again and at the BBC, and Jack had said to me that he had a copy of my book and I took it on holiday every year or something, just as a wee reminder. Back then, just as a wee reminder, because Jack had been part-time initially as well at Clyde, I think it was. So there have been loads of people that have commented on it positively. Nobody's really commented on it negatively. Not that many people have read it, Ian, but for fans of Queen of the South and Thistle at the time, it was quite a thing. And a lot of people, you know, commented on it to me directly. And I enjoyed doing it. I think it was, I look back in it, I don't read it or I don't thumb through it that often. I probably should, because there are loads of things that happened even in that year. My dad died while I was writing my book, which was actually ironic but beautiful at the same time, because I've now got something that can convey how I felt at the time. And again, I'd moved to Queen of the South in November. He died early December. And this is in my book. I'm sure it's in my book. In fact, if it's not in my book, I wrote it in a column, but I'm sure it's in my book. I'm 100% sure it's in my book. I went back up to the cemetery a day later, because after he was buried, it was a wee bit of a blur. But I went back up and I went round all the bouquets of flowers just to see, so that I could make sure I thanked people. And there was a beautiful bouquet of flowers from Partick Thistle, and I hadn't seen them the day before, from all your friends at Partick Thistle. I thought, they're football, that's magic, you know, it was lovely. I wasn't at the club anymore, but they'd sent a bouquet of flowers. So the book was, it was cathartic for me, but also an insight into part-time footballers and the sacrifices they make. Because to be involved in this, this is something that, you know, I know when I'm speaking to young footballers, make the sacrifice. If you're not willing to make the sacrifices, you'll be found out. You need to make the sacrifices. If you do it properly, if you make the right sacrifices when you're young, if you do it properly and you've got ability and you've got the attitude and you've got the temperament and you've got athleticism and all the other bits and pieces, and that sounds like a hell of a lot, and it is. But by the time you're 33, 34, you might be job done and you've got 20 million in the bank. You can then have your holidays and your nights out and play golf or do whatever it is you want to do. If you're wanting, and if you're not really willing to make the sacrifices, then there'll be an excuse.
Well, the book's called Don't Give Up the Day Job, and I'm pretty sure that if anyone presents there as a copy, you'll definitely sign it for them. And you're talking
happy
about,
to do so.
Well, you're talking there about making the most of their chances, and the way your career kind of ended, it was in effect, it's not always your decision when you stop playing football, and it was a kind of leg break that put you kind of on the downward slope towards retirement. But you were doing your football badges and they paid off, because you went into management. Dennis Muir took you on. How did you feel you transferred from playing into managing?
I think it was a fairly seamless transition for me, Ian. Because I'd finished, you know, there was no debate about, and I think, you know, had I not had a leg break, I would have played a significant part that season for John McVeigh, as it turned out. and possibly for 2 or 3 more seasons. However, the decision was taken away from me. It wasn't as if I was trying to get another contract because I think I can still do a job on the pitch. It was done. I was finished. So that made it easy for me to then think, right, what do I do now? Now, Stennis Muir were brilliant. They wanted me to be involved with, first of all, the youth team and under-19 team at that period. And they asked me to go and coach the under-19s, which I did. John McVeigh was fully supportive of that. And the chairman at the time, David Reid, was really keen to get me involved. And then when John results weren't great, John's tenure came to an end. The club asked Tony Smith, one of the players, one of the senior players at the time, and myself to take the team on the Saturday. We won, I think, 3 out of 4 games. And as is common, you know, we're then offered the job, but we take it as co-managers. So the agreement Tony and I had was that on game day, I looked after everything, training. The two of us would converse and chat about what we were going to discuss, what we were going to put into the session. So we would then discuss what the team would be. So we made joint decisions that way. But on a Saturday, I was calling the shots because Tony was still playing and I was seeing it from the side of the pitch. As it transpired, Tony's playing contract was up at the end of that season. And I think he was in a significant playing contract. And when he was then looking to renegotiate that with the club, not with me, it ended up he got a better offer elsewhere. So he left that and it was just me and the chair. Initially, I had approached John McCormick, ex-Dundee and Queen's Park manager and living legend of the Scottish game, Cowboy McCormick, to come in as my assistant. But the money was pretty poor in terms of it wasn't a full-time position and it wasn't even a well-paid part-time position, but that was just what it was. And John then got offered a manager job, so he left very quickly. And Paul Smith had just lost his job at Berwick Rangers. Paul I didn't really know, but I'd spoken to a number of people and they'd said Paul's a really good guy. I went and met Paul. Paul decided to come on as my assistant, and with a great 2 and a bit years, Paul's now with John McGlynn doing a fantastic job at Falkirk. But Smudger and I, you know, I was the boss. That was apparent. I leant on Paul because Paul was more experienced and slightly older and had been around the block a few times. So between us, it was a management team. He helped me transition into dealing with players. But in my day job, I managed people. So I didn't see it as being any different. What I did do back then, and I remember the club talking about it, was I had 1-to-1 interviews with each player. As soon as I took the job, I had 1-to-1 interviews basically to ask the players what their targets were. What did they see as their strengths? What did they see as their weaknesses? What could I help them do? What was their preferred position? What shape of team did they think they fitted into best? So that I could gather that information and feed it back to them, should they then say, that's not the position I want to play. Well, that's the position you told me you wanted to play. You know, that was one of your strengths, that was one of your weaknesses. We tried to work with that. But so it was almost a kind of a personal development programme for each of the players. That's what we tried to install. And we did. First season, Gretna ran away with the league. Absolutely ran away with the league. Second season, we ran away with the league until the final 6 games. And we blew up. And we literally blew up and we missed out by 1 point. Mixed Patalinas, Cowden, Beath pipped us in the final day of the season, but we were 9 points ahead getting into the last quarter of the season. And it was a horrific, horrific time to be at the club because there was real disappointment and real anger and a couple of things happened. A newspaper article, including one of the players, which I had to address and I did address and left the player under no illusions as to how I felt about it, probably in a manner that John Lambie would have been proud of. So there was a few things that started to come out and it was all about the dressing room being fractured and it absolutely wasn't, it was all manufactured, and it was because at that time I was still writing for The Sun and the Daily Record wanted to promote this story against, not me, but in terms of I was a Sun columnist, so the Record got the story. It shouldn't have ever got to the level it got to, pretty much front page of the Record about the behaviour of players in the dressing room, which wasn't true. And as a result, it ended up, when we lost the league, the start of the next season, there was still this, I refer to it as a stench, a kind of malaise, almost something that wasn't going to go away unless I went away. So I gave it until, I think it was late October. It was late October, and I know why. Late October, I went to a board meeting, and I basically asked if I still had the support of the board. A couple of people were really vocal, one being a fans member of the board, really vocal. I would have sacked you in the summer. I thought, okay, that's fair. Thanks for that. Somebody else says, well, I'm not quite sure. And I said, listen, I'll make this easy for you. I'll step back. I'm out. All over. Thanks for the opportunity, and I wish you all the best. And I flew to New York the following Thursday. That was a Monday. On the Thursday, I flew to New York to run the marathon for charity. And it was as if the weight of the world came off my shoulders. It was just, I was a part-time manager, but you're never part-time, because it's in your mind all the time. And it was literally in my head non-stop about the football. How do we deliver this season after failing last season? And I left the club, I think they were second in the league, and they were 2 points off the top. It took them a bit of time, and then they got up to the second level. And again, Gary Naismith won their first league championship last year, which is fantastic. And I love you, Gary, and I love the club. We should have delivered the first championship in the club's history, but we didn't. So that was the way it was.
You're like the Zsa Zsa of Scottish football days, with the amount of jilted former clubs that you've got. Never heard of so many people turning football clubs down. I think that's brilliant. You talk very much about being part-time when you were doing a lot of your... Do you think that's helped you in your life? Because a lot of professional footballers, they get to retirement and then they think, oh, what do I do now? But for you, you always had something bubbling in the background that you could develop.
Well, football was always... you know, a supplementary income or a supplementary job for me. So, but you're right, I've had numerous players speaking to me about how do I transition, what's the time to start thinking about looking at a career outside of football. And listen, I would be bold enough to say, I'm bold enough to say that if you're not playing in possibly the top five clubs in Scotland, then you're going to need a career outside of football. Even some of the players at Hearts, Hibs and Aberdeen, for example, aren't going to make enough money to call it quits at the end of the day. I mean, I think back to that Celtic group I went in to train with, the full-time guys that were playing in the first team, you know, Pat Bonner, and I think some of the guys I met. I saw Roy Aitken for the first time in a long time on Friday evening there at an event. McAvaney, who would have been one of the top earners in Scottish football at that point. These guys have had to go and work. They've had to go and continue to find employment, because there wasn't the kind of money back then that there is now. So I've had players for 20 years asking me, you know, when do you start thinking about it? And I say, well, you should be thinking about it right now, whether you're 22, 23 or 32, 33. You always need an escape route, because as it happened to me, you know, football finished for me immediately because of an injury. You're thinking you've got another 6 or 7 years. And they're talking to me and saying, I'm 26, I need to think about when I'm 34. No, you need to start thinking right now and think about what do you do to make up the football money that you're getting just now. What do you get? What do you do so that when you stop earning that, you've got it there? And I had a brilliant conversation, that this will remain confidential in terms of the name, but a high-profile individual came to me and asked me about coming out of full-time football and getting into part-time football, as well as getting into business, as in asking me, can you maybe help me get a job outside of football? So the individual got him a part-time contract with a club, facilitated them getting into work for a client of mine. So he was then basically earning what he would have been earning as a player in the Premiership Scotland. He then very quickly went into management, and now he's full-time back in, full-time management. For a period of time, he had it in his head that he needed to come out of that money and find it somewhere else. And that transition for him happened really quickly. But there are a lot of players who they're oblivious to the need to do that. And it's actually something that they should be acutely aware of, right from the off, you know, because if they don't get the big move, even if they get the big move and it happens late, they're still going to have to work when they're finished.
Also, one of the most important things that you do post-career, Des, is the fundraising for charity. Is that something you're very passionate about? Is that something that's you've maybe had, a lot of people had an experience in their life and then it kind of fuels them towards it? I know there's charities that I back for certain reasons. Is that something that you're very much driven to do?
It wasn't through personal circumstances that I get involved in Macmillan Cancer Support, Ian. However, and it coincides with my career finishing, my wee pal who co-wrote the book with me, Bill Leckie, Bill had signed up to do the New York City Marathon in 2003. He was turning 40 at the time, midlife crisis. The Macmillan nurses, as they were known back then, had cared for his father, who had passed away, Arthur Leckie. So when Bill had signed up for the New York City Marathon, November 2003, I was lying, broken leg in the summer of 2002, and he told me that he was going to be doing this. I said, well, listen, if I'm able to run, I knew that I wasn't going to be able to play football, but and then twisting was going to be the problem because of the leg break. Straight lines, I'd be okay. If the surgeon gives me the okay, could you get me a spot in it? Because that'd be a hell of a target for me to get to. Right, okay. So it transpires that I get this place in the New York City Marathon. No personal circumstances, no personal experience with Macmillan Cancer Support. Between signing up and actually running the marathon and doing all the fundraising that we were doing, I have to tell you that the outpouring of positive experiences people had with Macmillan, it was overwhelming. Everywhere I turned, people were telling me, Macmillan helped me with my mum, helped me with my brother, helped me with whatever. It was amazing. So I thought right then, right, that's it. I'm going to continue to do this as a fundraising thing. Macmillan, I'll do stuff for Macmillan. So the next year I ran, went back to New York. So Bill and I did it in 2003. The next year, six of us went, and you had to raise $3,000 or $2,500 each. The next year, I think there was 10 of us. But then it started to diversify. And now we do a number of different events every year, whether it's ladies' lunches, sporting dinners, sporting lunches, golf days, physical challenges. So each year, our team of individuals, a group, core group of people, organise and raise $200,000 to $250,000 a year through events and challenges. And there's a byproduct of the challenge. We've watched and listened to that. We're now at kind of 2.2 million since 2003. That 2.2 million has been put together by literally thousands of unique individuals that have been involved with our events. So London Marathon, I think there's maybe about 140 unique individuals have now done the London Marathon, their fundraising team. But there are people that have done marathons that 2 years previous would have not been able to walk the length themselves. We've got people going up and down Ben Nevis and doing three peak challenges, and it's driven individuals to more healthy lifestyles, more activity. So the byproduct of Macmillan get the chunk and we raise awareness of the services, but the individuals involved get fit, get better mental health, get a better idea of how they should be living their life. And that's not because we're telling them that, they're just experiencing it. So it's a huge part of my life, I have to tell you. It's brilliant. I love it. Macmillan have been phenomenal. We've been really blessed to have, and I've kind of substituted my physical activity of football and my team work within the dressing room to being now part of this fundraising team. And my physical bit is I cycle challenges. We're away to Morocco in 10 days for seven days trekking in the Atlas Mountains and then into the Sahara. We've done Kilimanjaro, we've done the Great Wall, we've cycled everywhere. I mean, it's phenomenal and I love it. And the people that we've met and get friendly with and close up to because of it has been tremendous.
I think that's absolutely commendable, Des. Now, Alex Smith identified that you're very quick of thought, so let's fire out some fun and see how you get.
No, on you go.
Right, who's the best opponent you ever faced?
That's a Churchich.
Okay, that's a good one. Best teammate you ever had?
Played against them twice, Ian. Played against him when he was at Bolton Wanderers, sorry, Partizan Belgrade in a friendly at Palmerston. He moved afterwards for $1 million to Bolton Wanderers. Played against him, Bolton Wanderers in a pre-season friendly at Palmerston. He immediately moved to Aston Villa for $4 million. Played against me twice and he's had two moves at it.
Best teammate you've ever had?
I'm going to pass him. That's too difficult. I've got some brilliant, brilliant memories of brilliant, brilliant people. I honestly couldn't pick out one. I really couldn't pick out one because I've been lucky to have guys that I could depend on and trust in all sorts of ways alongside me.
Best goal you scored?
Oh, what a question that is. And it'll be a goal that I used regularly whenever I'm with them. And it was in a reserve game. I was actually playing a reserve game for Queen of the South at Somerset when Scotland's number one at three World Cups, Alan Ruff, was coming to the end of his career. He was playing, I think he was the goalkeeping coach, and I have hit a volley from 20 yards with my right foot, which I stood on, my right foot right into the top corner, and it was phenomenal, but nobody saw it. It was unfortunate. It wasn't in the telly, it wasn't even in a website, but I remember it, and Big Ruffy clearly doesn't remember it, but because everybody scored against him. But that was my favourite goal, or my best goal.
Wonder if Zico's favourite goal was against Ruffy as well.
Zico, I think he scored about 10 against him. don't start me about Kubilas, anyway.
John Walker had a great story about Zico, how he was able to swap shots with him just because he had a thing about collecting number 10s. So he turned down Dalglish and Souness and went straight to John Walker because Walker wore 10.
Hey, John Walker.
What's the best stadium you've played at?
Oh, best stadium I've played at? Oh, that's... God, I don't know, mate. That's a great question. Never ever even really thought about it. Best stadium I've played at?
It has to be Clifton Hill, surely.
Maybe no. probably Celtic Park.
Okay.
Didn't get into Europe.
best use of a John Lambie swear word?
Best use of a John Lambie swear word? Getting it back to him. Giving it back to him in the exact same tone that he gave it to you.
Oh, yeah, that's good. And finally, what's the best crowd chant you've ever heard?
I'm going to tell you this one. So, when I signed at Partick Thistle, the captain, Tommy Bryce had signed me. And I'm actually friendly with a guy that shouted this. I see him every now. He lives in Cumbernauld. I live in Cumbernauld. And we were struggling at Methil against East Fife, clearly. All the big games I played in. And he's shouting at me. I don't know what I've done, but one of the boys told me later on, he's shouting, "Captain! Captain! Captain Pugwash!" So that was what I was christened after that. The boys used to just come into the Aitken suite at Firhill and just said to me, "All right, Pugwash." I'm like, "Aye, cheers, boys. Thanks." So that's the best shout I've heard, about me. So Captain Pugwash was referred, I was referred to as Captain Pugwash.
Well, that brings us to the end of another episode of the CSI Football Podcast. I am delighted to announce that Des has not broken up with me. I must be the only person that's managed to achieve that in Scottish football. Join us next episode for another journey into the annals of Scottish football. Our website is at csi.com and you can find all our socials. It just leaves me to thank a very entertaining Des McKeown. Thank you very much, Des.
Cheers, Ian. My pleasure. Thank you.